This is Law and Disorder. Today on Law and Disorder, we're going to talk about one of the most remarkable demonstrations in years. Code Pink and thousands of Pakistanis protested against drone killings in Pakistan. How many more years can we commemorate the anniversary of our continuous war in Afghanistan? We're going into year 12, and we'll hear from Phyllis Bennis about a war that never seems to end.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights. We don't often have really good news for you on Law and Disorder, but here's one that's really great. For a long time, we've been covering Coalition for Immokalee Workers and their struggle to get companies to sign fair food agreements with them. Remember, CIW, the coalition, represents farm workers in Florida, in Immokalee, Florida, some 30,000 farm workers who pick under terrible conditions with terrible wages. They've won their struggle against a number of companies, McDonald's, Taco Bell, Yum Yum Brands, Whole Foods, etc. Well, they've had a big struggle going on for a long time, 6 years, against Chipotle Mexican Grill. Now, I know a lot of you probably eat at the Chipotle Mexican Grill. It's considered the slower of the fast food, and it's supposed to be okay. Well, for years they resisted signing an agreement with CIW. Finally, on October 4th, Chipotle Mexican Grill and the Coalition of Immokalee Workers signed an agreement that brings Chipotle's commitment to sustainable food to the CIW's Fair Food Program. The agreement improves wages and working conditions for farm workers in Florida who pick tomatoes for Chipotle. It's the 11th company that has signed with the CIW. The mass of companies that are signing is getting bigger and bigger. Next, look for CIW to continue its campaign against some of the big supermarkets, Publix, Kroger's, and others. If you want to learn more about this victory, an amazing victory for farm workers who are not protected by unions, an amazing victory for farm workers, go to the CIW website. That's www.ciw-online.org. CIW-online.org, or just put in CIW and I'm sure you'll get it. But it's an incredible victory. It's been many years of struggle for really the lowest level of worker in our society, farm workers. Congratulations, CIW. Thank you, Chipotle, for finally signing the Fair Foods Agreement. We want to bring you this update, and it's on the subject of who gets prosecuted and who doesn't, who serves time and who doesn't. Here's what happened. People may recall that under George Bush, he engaged in a program of warrantless wiretapping. It was done after 9/11. It was done outside the law. It was done secretly. It was ultimately exposed. Completely illegal. Utterly illegal. So illegal that former Vice President Gore said that Bush ought to be impeached for it. But then what happened? And here's what gets interesting. Obama in the Senate, originally, of course, was upset by it, said it shouldn't have happened, and said that he would not vote for legislation, which was going through the Senate and the House, that would give immunity, particularly to the telecoms or the telecommunications companies, for engaging in this warrantless wiretapping of American citizens along with the government or doing that at the government's request. In the end, what happened is Bush does this illegal act. Nothing happens to Bush or his minions for engaging in thousands of warrantless wiretaps, illegal, contrary to the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution and violative of the criminal law. And eventually, Congress passes a law that gives immunity to the telecoms for engaging in what was clearly illegal conduct. In other words, cooperating with the U.S. government, illegally wiretapping American citizens without any kind of court order and warrant. Obama is one of his early big failures. Initially, as I said, said he would not give immunity to the telecoms. But one of his last acts when he was in the Senate before he took the presidency, he voted in favor of giving immunity to the telecoms. So that's where that stands. Then there's been litigation, scores of cases challenging that immunity. The latest case, and probably the most important one, was the Electronic Frontier Foundation, along with the ACLU, went to court saying it's illegal to give immunity to these private telecoms. They violated the law. How can Congress just decide willy-nilly to give immunity? They lost in the lowest court. They lost in the middle court. And then, on their way to the Supreme Court, what do you think the Supreme Court did last week? They basically said, we're not going to look at that case, which effectively upholds the immunity of the telecoms who engaged in warrantless wiretapping that was clearly and flatly illegal. So there you have instance one. When the big corporations or the president and others violate the law, what do they get? They don't just get no punishment, but they actually get immunized. Let's give another recent example of that. Most of you may not have heard of the MEK. The MEK was an Iranian group that was put on the terrorist list by the United States. Many of them live in Iraq because at one point they had to flee from Iran, but they're on the terrorist list, the MEK. Or I should say, were on the terrorist list until a few days ago. Now, none of us are particularly in love with these terrorist lists because there's no real due process. The U.S. puts on who it wants, but it did put on MEK many years ago, a number of years ago. Since that time, the most interesting fact has been that a number of politicians have supported the MEK and actually taken speaking fees that could be traced back to the MEK. Now, under the U.S. terrorism law, it's illegal to take fees if they're from the MEK or if they're from a group that's a front for the MEK or if they're diverted through funny ways to get to you. Really big politicians did this. I don't recall all the names, but, you know, a score of Bush politicians took a lot of money, $50,000, $100,000. It's a violation of the law. They should have been prosecuted. And you know from instances where they've prosecuted Palestinians for engaging in any kind of contact, even if it's not proven, even if it's, you know, very circumlocutious, that it goes all around. They prosecute Palestinians all the time for having any dealings with Hamas at all, even if it's the human rights groups in Gaza who the U.S. government claims are affiliated with Hamas. They get prosecuted. So what happens last week? A decision was made to no longer list the MEK as a terrorist group. Whatever one thinks of that, that's one thing. But the violation of the law was still there by top U.S. officials. Did any of them get prosecuted? Was there any even investigation of them? Absolutely not. It's a clear violation of the law. The fact that the MEK later got taken off the terrorist list is not a defense to the fact that while it was on the list, someone, somewhere, our politicians, got money from the MEK. So there you go, another example of how major criminal law violations by those in power get impunity or don't get investigated. Now let's give you an example where the opposite happens. I got a note from some people who were holding a vigil in New York City last week on what's the upcoming 12th year of the Afghan War. They were all veterans of the Vietnam War. 25 people, most of them veterans actually, not all of them, were arrested while they were laying flowers at a war memorial in New York City on October 7th. They were engaged in a peaceful vigil to honor those killed and wounded in war and oppose the U.S. war in Afghanistan as it enters its 12th year. So think about that. As these protesters were reading the names of New York soldiers killed in Vietnam who were commemorated at the plaza, and they were reading the military dead in Afghanistan, the police informed them that the park was closed, and if they remained, they would be arrested. Many chose to continue reading the names, were handcuffed, and taken away. One of them was World War II Army combat veteran Jay Wenk, 85 years old, from Woodstock, New York. So that's what happens when you honor those who died in illegitimate U.S. wars, and when you demand an end to the war
11-year war in Afghanistan, and all U.S. wars of aggression, and you remember those killed and wounded by war, what does the government and the police do? They arrest you. When you support the MEK, a terrorist group, or take money from them, or you illegally, warrantlessly wiretap American citizens, what happens? You get impunity from the government. Equal justice under law. Two weeks ago, a delegation of 40 members from Code Pink traveled to Pakistan protesting U.S. drone strikes. The group is also visiting families of those injured or killed by drones. The Code Pink delegation is made up of students, doctors, veterans, retirees, and artists. They were joined on what became a massive anti-drone march with many people from Pakistan on their way to an area that's constantly droned, South Waziristan. In one statistic, within 2 years, more than 90 drone attacks have killed more than 5,000 innocent Pakistanis. Today we get an update on the delegation from Code Pink member Ray Abele. Ray is the co-director of Code Pink Women for Peace. She is also a founding member of Young Jewish and Proud, the youth wing of Jewish Voice for Peace. Ray, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Great to be on. Thanks.
So we're here to talk about Code Pink and what they recently did in Pakistan with regard to drones. Now, first of all, you work for Code Pink?
Yeah, I'm the co-director of Code Pink nationally, and I've been joyously with the organization for the past 8 years.
And as I recall, or you recall to me, we tried to get into Gaza together.
That's right.
How many years ago? 2 years ago?
It was 2 years ago, a year after the Israeli attack on Gaza, Operation Cast Lead.
And before Arab Spring.
Right.
But Cairo
right.
was so pretty intense.
We were protesting in Tahrir Square before it was the Tahrir Square it is now.
It's true. I remember it. But it was very intense in Cairo then.
Yeah.
I remember because I had my kids there, and it was always nerve-wracking because there were, you know, cops and undercover everywhere.
Yeah, well, that was a tremendous effort. 1,400 people from all over the world trying to get into Gaza to right. break the siege, deliver medical aid, and just yet another example of a Code Pink trip to try to cross through borders and get where no one else is going.
No, Code Pink is remarkable. So tell me a little bit about, first of all, how did this march come about, the one in Pakistan against drones?
Well, Medea Benjamin, the co-founder of Code Pink, has been doing work on drones for about the past year and a half. We organized one of the first international drone conference in D.C. She recently wrote a book, Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control, and she's been on this national book tour. And organically, out of that work, came the urgent need to take a delegation of Americans to Pakistan and witness firsthand the effect of these drone attacks and meet with survivors and deliver medical aid. So she partnered with PTI, a Pakistani political party, and their leader Imran Khan, as well as with Shahzad, who's a well-known lawyer for drone victims. And they got this delegation rolling and ended up with 35 Americans from all over the country in Islamabad, setting out on this caravan to march to a place where really in the past decade, no Americans have gone to.
First of all, the book. Say the name of the book again. I've read the book. It's a great book. If you want just a really good primer on what is drone warfare about, it's the book. But what's the name again?
Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control by Medea Benjamin. And you're right. It's a great read, short book, gets right to the heart of the matter.
So it came about that you're going to do this march. And when I first heard about the march, I always think it's good to do these things, but it seemed to me one of the most dangerous things people could undertake. Tell us about that. I mean, what did you think about the risks? What did people think? Didn't they? You know, Pakistan is not the most stable place.
This was one of our more dangerous international delegations, and I had serious concerns about the group going on the trip, particularly because they were leaving the United States for Pakistan only a week after the whole Muslim film controversy and the serious anti-American protests happening throughout the Muslim world. So they were entering into a dicey situation for sure. Actually, before they set off on the march, the U.S. ambassador to Pakistan met them at their hotel in Islamabad and warned them strongly of the possibility of suicide bombers or attacks by the Taliban, but they felt it was very important to put their bodies on the line and to go and join with these thousands of Pakistanis going on this march and really take a stand. So tremendously courageous.
Yeah, I remember reading the papers here about the warnings, and I said, oh my God, this sounds terrible. I mean, anything could happen.
Right, but you know, this is what the Pakistani people living in Waziristan and these tribal areas are living with daily. They're hearing the constant sound of drones going overhead. They don't know when the next attack attack is going to come, who is going to target, you know, so even just getting a taste of that for a couple days gives you tremendous sympathy for what people are dealing with because of our tax dollars and our drones.
Now tell me, where did the march begin from?
Started out in Islamabad with a car caravan of, I understand, over 100 vehicles, and they drove for hours and hours, over a day, I think.
Mostly Pakistani, right?
Yes. Everyone was Pakistani except for the 32 Americans, maybe some international press.
Wow.
And they said every little town and village they went to, they were just greeted by throngs of supporters, people who said, welcome, welcome, thank you, we want peace. You know, just tremendous support for peace there.
And its goal was to get to where?
The goal was to get into South Waziristan, to the epicenter of the U.S. drone attacks. And they were stopped shortly before reaching the furthest most point that they hoped to march to by the Pakistani government, who put up these huge truck trailers and created roadblocks and wouldn't allow them to go further for what they said was security concern reasons.
And what happened when they were stopped? What'd they do?
They had a rally, and from what I understand from Media, there was this beautiful rally with Imran Khan where they got to address the thousands of Pakistanis there and apologize publicly for the effects of these killer drone attacks. And people all sang together, we want peace. They sang, we are marching for a peaceful world, to the tune of When the Saints Go Marching In, and just beautiful right. moments. There's some great videos up on our site, droneswatch.org.
But it was real courage. I have to say, when I read about it, I said, oh, my God, I've been on things with Medea, but this one seemed one I didn't really want to go on.
Yeah, this was really tremendous, and it's been just amazing to see their photos and videos. Yeah. And now they're safely back in Islamabad. They organized a fast all day. They had a fast outside of the marketplace to atone for killer drone attacks.
Now, on this march, were there people whose families had been killed or injured by drones? Did they get to talk to people? What was the reaction of the countryside?
From day one, when the delegation got to Pakistan, they've been meeting with families of drone victims and drone victim survivors and hearing these harrowing tales. You know, one story that sticks out in my mind that's been widely covered in the news is the story of 16-year-old Tariq Aziz. This is a young man who was advocating for drone victims and goes to a wedding. He's in the car with his aunt and his 12-year-old cousin. They're driving back from a wedding and they get hit by a Hellfire missile from a drone attack and killed. You know, and it's just, this is just killing our children. It's outrageous. So I think they've heard some heartbreaking stories on this trip.
Do you have some sense of what overall, how many drones are used in Pakistan, Afghanistan? I mean, give us some, how many people have been killed?
There's over 2,500 people who have been killed by drone attacks. I believe the numbers are fuzzy. We don't have very accurate data, particularly from these tribal regions where the drone attacks are happening. The U.S. government continues to reinforce that drones are only killing military, which is not true, but President Obama has declared all young men in Pakistan to be potential militants, you know, so it kind of gives the green light for a shooting on civilians.
Yeah, no, that's interesting, you know, because I guess there's, what I read about a little bit is two kinds of attacks. One are called signature attacks and the other personality attacks. Personality, they at least know the person's name. It's not great. It's horrible. The other one, signature, are just if they see young Muslim men in a group, they just figure these guys are militants, as you just said, and we can kill them.
Right, and let's think about how that killing is happening. This is a robotic plane thousands of miles away. It's being controlled by a remote control at an Air Force base like Creech out in Las Vegas. These soldiers are sitting there all day looking at this screen as if it's a video game, and then finally, you know, decide to attack. And I think they're suffering, a lot of these soldiers, from boredom, from PTSD themselves. It's a very strange reality that these military pilots are going to work during the day, pressing buttons that kill people thousands of miles away and then going home to the dinner table with their families in Vegas at night.
No, it is weird. And it's also weird, I think maybe Medea's book brings out some of that, but you know, they see the people in their everyday lives. They see people playing with their kids and they say, oh, we don't want to hit them with their kids. And so the guy steps out and then they kill him. And then they see the kids all getting the body or weeping. I mean, it's pretty dramatic stuff.
It's horrific, and it's a primary tool for attracting militants to join the Taliban. And it's increasing, you know, anti-American sentiment and increasing terrorism, I think. I mean, it's a no-brainer that, you know, if you kill someone's father or their kid, they're going to want to retaliate. Surprising more people don't.
Yeah, it's amazing that it hasn't gotten more of an outcry.
Well, it's been a huge success of this delegation, I think, that this peace march has made international news. It's been on every major network and really broken the sound barrier around this. And a year ago, when Medea started researching for the drone warfare book, you know, people really weren't talking about this. And now we're seeing reports coming out, a great report from NYU and Stanford University, right, just published recently, as well as other reports really documenting how offensive this warfare is.
How did the media in Pakistan treat Medea and the Code Pink people, and even Imran Khan, who was, I know, a political candidate eventually for the next president of Pakistan?
Well, Imran Khan is quite the celebrity in Pakistan. He's a former cricket player.
Famous cricket player.
Famous. Sports celebrity. Right. Now he's turned political career, you know, potentially the next leader of Pakistan. So you can imagine the reception that they received from the Pakistani press everywhere they went, both for Imran Khan and then also the spotlight on these Americans joining in was definitely newsworthy.
Was there any real opposition to within Pakistan to them being there?
I haven't heard of reports of opposition. There has been outcry for opposing the brutal actions of the Taliban as well, and saying it's not just the U.S. drone missiles, but we need to also speak out about that violence. Code Pink actually condemned and spoke out against the Taliban shooting of a young 14-year-old woman named Malala. She's been an outspoken advocate for girls going to school, and she was recently targeted by the Taliban and is in critical condition for brain injuries. And so we're trying to fundraise for funds to donate to the school that she was going to and getting her urgent neurological care. But I think it's so important to speak out against the violence that the Taliban is committing as well.
So Medea and 35 Code Pink people or so are back in the United States. What are the plans now in the U.S. around drones, et cetera? I know we at my office, of course, the center, we have lawsuits all the time, but of course we're getting killed in those, but there's still an element, you know, we represent Elawaki's grandfather, the grandfather of the two people who were killed, his son and as well as the 16-year-old boy in Yemen, which is what a terrible case. I mean, the 16-year-old kid, both of them, but terrible. But we haven't made much headway, and there doesn't seem to be a lot of headway, certainly within the Obama administration, certainly not in the Romney administration, around stopping this practice, because I guess they see it's a cheap way. You don't kill American soldiers. So what are you guys planning here in the U.S. around drones?
Well, now that the delegates are home, they're doing speaking events in their communities, at churches, and at university campuses around the country. Medea Benjamin's continuing her national speaking tour. She's actually coming to New York City on October 29th to speak at an event at the Culture Project here in Manhattan. And all of the delegates are available for events on our website, droneswatch.org. You can get a flavor of the tour happening. And then also, we're continuing to build grassroots support to oppose Obama's drone program. So during the delegation, we actually were able to deliver thousands of signatures collected on a Stop Drones petition directly to Obama at one of his fundraisers in San Francisco. One of his major donors, who's also a Code Pinker, took all these petitions in and confronted him about it, which I think is so important to bring it directly to him. And also, of course, to all of our Congress people, we're going to keep pressuring them, calling Congress, making appointments, and saying this is unacceptable. And then there's one other piece here, Michael, about this whole issue, which is, of course, the corporate funding and politics. And we look at how in Congress there's actually a drones caucus. And the leaders of the drones caucus, congresspeople like Bill Buck McKeon, are taking hundreds of thousands of dollars from drone manufacturers. So it's no wonder that we keep giving more and more money into this emerging robotic warfare program.
The figures are huge. The charts both of number of drone attacks since Obama's taken office, which is, I mean, if you say it's 50 times Bush, you'd probably be still not as many as Obama's using. But the money, which went from probably a few hundred million dollars or something to billions now that are being spent on drones, is extraordinary.
That's right. Yeah. And there's also a domestic spying drones program. So lots of local police forces are vying to get these national security grants to get their own drone to spy on us as U.S. citizens. They're being used on the U.S.-Mexico border. You know, there's kind of no stopping the growth of this technology. So we really need to build an international movement to speak out against killer drones and surveillance drones that violate our civil liberties here at home.
I mean, I read a lot about this area, and, you know, it's just such an easy thing for this government in their view. And to just put guys out. And where are these drone guys? There's some in Las Vegas or Nevada. There's some upstate New York.
Virginia,
right?
As well.
Right, who operate these. And it's crazy. And they're killing people thousands, tens of thousands of miles away with very little identification. I mean, our view, of course, at the center is that the whole thing is completely illegal. Let's look at where you were in Pakistan. There's no war in Pakistan. Why couldn't you just launch a drone in the United States tomorrow? Why couldn't you launch one in the UK if there's somebody you wanted to get? The whole thing is completely off the charts.
That's right. And like you mentioned, you know, Americans have been killed by these drone attacks overseas. So this is totally out of hand. And it's completely transforming the way that the U.S. wages war and the way we engage internationally. So it's a huge problem. I should mention also that Code Pink continues to organize protests outside of the drone bases in California, Beale Air Force Base and Creech Air Force Base. We have regular
Where are those?
Outside.
Beale and Creech? Where
Beale
are
is in Northern California, and Creech is about an hour outside of Vegas.
And say the drone site again, which I'm sure has all this information on it.
Yeah, for more info, folks can check out droneswatch.org. And there's great articles, resources. You can sign on to our petition to Obama to say no to drone warfare and find other great resources, droneswatch.org and codepink.org.
Ray, I know you're an activist on Palestine. In fact, there's a group that you belong to. What's the name of the group?
Both through Code Pink and Jewish Voice for Peace.
But then there's a special young...
And I helped to start the Young Jewish Proud, which is the youth wing of Jewish Voice for Peace.
Right, and that you did with my cousin Emily Ratner when you guys, I wouldn't say disrupted.
That's right, one of my heroes.
Right, when you protested Netanyahu, or Bibi, his speech in New Orleans.
Yes.
And this weekend, your hero obviously been coordinating all the Code Pink and drone stuff, but you also came to the Russell Tribunal, recently held in New York. What'd you think of it?
It's a people's tribunal, so it's not accountable under the International Criminal Court, but it creates a legal type environment in which to put Israel on trial for war crimes. And this is the fourth and final year, so they've had sessions in Barcelona, in London, South Africa, and here in New York. I spoke and testified at the Russell Tribunal on Palestine in London 2 years ago, which examined corporate complicity for Israeli war crimes. So this is looking at companies like Israeli settlement beauty products, Ahava, or SodaStream, or that are profiting from the occupation.
All you listeners out there who have SodaStream, and I'm sure there's plenty, because it's like the monopoly company, don't have it.
Yes, and there are alternatives to SodaStream. Check out stopsodastream.org. We have a whole list of alternatives.
Good.
But SodaStream is manufactured in an illegal settlement, Mishor Adamim, in the occupied territories. So we want to protest that product. And so that was a really interesting session in London, and gave a lot of information, was created out of there that's useful for boycott and divestment campaigns to nonviolently, economically pressure Israel to uphold international law. Here in New York, it was a bit more gloom and doom. We were looking at the role of the U.S. government and the U.N. in being complicit with Israeli war crimes. A lot of good information shared, and the recommendation that came out of this tribunal was to support boycott, divestment, and sanctions, to try to push for cases at the ICC, International Criminal Court, to hold Israel accountable, and to try to shift the UN, given that the U.S. has this strong veto power. It just seems like we can't get anywhere in holding Israel accountable. And it was very moving to be at the tribunal, because the jurors were these all-star activists and celebrities like Roger Waters from Pink Floyd, Angela Davis, Alice Walker, just really inspiring speakers.
We interviewed Alice and Dennis Banks on our show, and they were both incredibly moving, and Dennis in particular talked about, you know, the taking of Indian lands, his own lands, and what was done to him, basically put into an orphanage and never got to see his mother, etc.
Yes,
and really talking about the sense of those two struggles together, which I think is really accurate in terms of they're both about really taking someone else's land.
Right, and the struggle for indigenous rights.
Congratulations on Code Pink.
It's wonderful to be on air and not in jail here in New York, and I look forward to talking with you soon.
Great.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Madness, madness, they call it madness. Madness, madness, they call it madness. To see that is what they mean to me. madness. Madness, madness, they call it madness. Madness, madness, they call it madness. I'm about to explain that someone is using his brain. Madness, madness, they call it madness.
This month marks 11 years since the war in Afghanistan was launched. Operation Enduring Freedom includes the United States, the United Kingdom, Australia, the Afghan United Front, and NATO. Today we get an update on this 11th anniversary of the Afghanistan war. Really, now we're entering the 12th year. The update is from Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. Phyllis has been a writer, analyst, and activist on Middle East and UN issues for many years. Phyllis, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Great to be with you, Michael.
So, Phyllis, here we are again, another anniversary of the war in Afghanistan. I guess we're at 11 years and going into the 12th. So how many more years do we have?
11 years going into the 12th. This is already the longest war in U.S. history. I don't know how many more years we have. We hear from President Obama that by the end of 2014, combat troops will be withdrawn. That was the same kind of thing Bush tried in Iraq, where he kept talking about withdrawing combat troops, leaving behind who knows how many other kinds of troops, whether it's special forces, whether it's trainers, whether it's mercenaries, we don't know. But the U.S. occupation of Afghanistan could go on for a very long time. At the same time, we're hearing new calls from different forces, including most recently the Secretary General of NATO, who indicated that there was a possibility that NATO may decide to pull out its troops earlier than the end of 2014 because of the rise in these so-called insider killings, the attacks on U.S. and some other NATO soldiers, mainly U.S. soldiers, by Afghan troops and Afghan police that they are supposed to be training. And what a surprise, the U.S. and NATO doesn't know what to do about that. But the casualties on the U.S. side are rising very, very fast. And of course, what we don't ever hear about, Michael, and you know more about this than most from the lawsuits that we've done over the years to try and get some of this information, we don't have any idea how many thousands of Afghan civilians now have been killed and are continuing to be killed in these airstrikes, in attacks on communities, in against civilians. It's been a devastating, devastating war for people in that country, and we hear almost nothing about what happens to the people on the ground.
You probably know the most about that of anybody I've spoken to. Do you have any sense of how many civilian casualties there have been in Afghanistan?
Well, the only figures that we have that the U.S. acknowledges, and this means that it's way low, began in 2007. They began counting some confirmed deaths. Nobody believes that this is an accurate total. But their figures, the Pentagon figures from 2007 until the beginning of this year, until I think it was March of 2012, is 12,900 and something Afghan civilians. So almost 13,000 Afghan civilians only since 2007. that means that they're leaving out the first 5 years of the war, including the first months that saw that massive carpet bombing of the country, where the casualties were just out of control. So the numbers are just huge, absolutely huge.
Let me step back for a second. Right now, it's a NATO war. U.S. is going in as part of NATO, is that right?
The U.S. is there in two ways. The U.S. has a commander who, what a convenient coincidence, happens to be the NATO commander. You know, the U.S. never puts its troops under any other command.
Yes.
So some U.S. troops are there under under NATO command because the NATO commander is an American general. Other U.S. troops are there separately under U.S. control. So the U.S. has kind of double control. The U.S. has almost 70,000 troops there now. NATO has about 40,000 other troops. And there are about 90,000 U.S.-paid contractors, what you and I might identify as mercenaries, some of them Afghans, mostly not, who are there playing the role that in any normal war would be played by low-ranking soldiers. You know, things like driving trucks and cooking and cleaning barracks and that sort of thing.
The troops are still all there. And how many people, how many American soldiers have been killed, and how many since Obama has taken over the war?
Well, you know, the numbers, for all that we think that the U.S. is so careful about keeping track of its own casualties, even that is right now unclear. Last week, a number of press outlets, including the Washington Post, AP, and some others, reported the 2,000th U.S. military casualty. But the New York Times had reported that as early as September of this year, and CBS News had reported 2,000 U.S. casualties last June, June 21st. So we don't even really know how many U.S. military casualties there have been, but it's been now more than 2,000. Now, in the immediate period, we've seen more than 54 U.S. troops killed just in the last year or so by so-called Afghan allies. You know, these are either Afghan troops that are being trained by these U.S. soldiers, or in a couple of cases, it's Afghan police. And in those cases, what's so interesting is the U.S. actually admits that less than 25% of them, less than one out of four, actually have anything to do with so-called Taliban infiltration. The rest, they say, we don't know what causes it. It seems to be personal animosity and personal arguments. And you want to say, wait a minute, are you serious?
What do you think?
We're going to believe that? Well, I mean, what they're dealing with is people, you know, people in Afghanistan, young men in Afghanistan, join the military for the same reason that young people in the United States join the military, because they're desperate for a job. And people join the military doesn't mean that if you're in Afghanistan, the fact that you join the military doesn't mean that you necessarily believe that you want foreign occupiers controlling your country. So the fact that you may join the military doesn't change your mind. You may join for a job, and you may then decide, you know what, I've got an opportunity here to do something I sort of always wanted to do, to get these people out of my country. You know, and we're seeing the effect of it. We, as I mentioned, the Secretary General of NATO is saying that maybe we should consider withdrawing early because of these so-called green-on-blue attacks. And so people are outraged at what the military is doing. The fact of an occupation is bad enough, but you add to that the direct attacks on civilians that are continuing. I mean, remember, just a couple of weeks ago, 9 Afghan women and several little girls were killed gathering wood before dawn to build a fire, to make breakfast for their families. And they were killed directly by a U.S. airstrike. And the Pentagon said, oh, sorry, and then somehow think that that's going to make it all okay. Think that people forget about those incidents, as if they have no impact on how people see the U.S. soldiers that they're supposed to be working with, they're supposed to be learning from. Add to that the lack of any cultural sensitivity, the lack of language training, so that there's no sense from soldiers on the ground that they have any idea what this culture is about, who these people are, what languages they speak, how they live, what their understanding of religion is. None of these things. So the collective impact of all of that is that the U.S. troops, even those who are training Afghan soldiers and may have perfectly decent, if rather shallow, human ties with their counterparts, there's absolutely no reason to think that the majority of Afghans in and out of the military view those U.S. soldiers as anything more than one more militia that's creating problems for them, even though it happens to be better armed than and bigger than any of the other militias in town.
So now, Phyllis, the year that Obama's given is 2014, January, the end of 2014.
End of 2014.
For supposedly getting combat troops out, which you've explained
right.
doesn't mean all the troops.
Right.
Do you think that's going to work? Do you think it's really going to happen? What does it really mean? And describe the country a little bit, because, of course, from my images from just reading, it's just like you have the capital and you have Karzai and then you have all kinds of power bases everywhere else. And it's what's going to happen?
That's a pretty good description, Michael. You have the capital. You have Karzai, who's known as the mayor of Kabul, because his writ doesn't really extend much beyond the borders of the city. It doesn't even extend to all parts of the city. The vast majority of people in Afghanistan, it's a population of about 25 million people, the vast majority don't live in the cities. They live in tiny hamlets and small towns, small villages, very scattered. It's a very rural country. It's not a developed country in terms of easy transport between cities, between towns. People tend to live in many ways very isolated lives in their villages. So their identity, historically, people in that region, whether it was part of a bigger empire or part of a smaller empire, people's own identity was always bound up with very small identities, with their family, their clan, their tribe, maybe their language group, but really not identifying very strongly with a big country. You know, this notion that the U.S. had when they overturned the Taliban government and said, well, we're going to take it over and we're going to install a strong national government, that flew in the face of what Afghanistan had always been. It was true in Iraq. There had always been strong central governments in Iraq. In Afghanistan, it was the opposite. And the U.S. simply imposed their own version of what a government should look like. The result has been that it's had very little impact on the lives of people in most of the country. What it will mean is far more a political question than a military question. I don't think there's any difference that we're going to see whether all the troops were pulled out last week, as you and I might advocate, versus if even all the troops were pulled out at the end of 2014. When they're gone, there's going to continue to be a struggle for power. Unfortunately, it will probably be at least partly a violent military struggle between various political forces, many of whom are now better armed than they were before. But whether we stay or go is not really going to change it. I think part of the reason we're hearing nothing about the Afghanistan war from the debates and from the campaigns on either side is because there's nothing to brag about for President Obama. You can only brag about killing Osama bin Laden so many times, although maybe he hasn't reached that maximum yet. We'll probably hear a bit more of that. But there's nothing to brag about on the ground in Afghanistan. There's nothing to brag about except for the fact that I'm going to pull out. And there's not much that Romney can say because he doesn't have any better idea. He's saying that Obama's not tough enough, but his actual policy is virtually identical. He just wants stronger language. So what we're seeing is an actual expansion of the so-called global war on terror. We now have the drone war, which has become in many ways the signature war of the Obama administration, that has expanded beyond Afghanistan alone and now beyond Pakistan into at least Yemen and Somalia and maybe beyond. We don't even know all the places where drones are being used. So we are seeing a legacy after 4 years of the Obama administration of a really vast expansion of the global war on terror, which he said he was going to completely reverse and do things differently. They haven't done things differently. They've just done them bigger.
Phyllis, if you were faced tomorrow with what to do about Afghanistan, and I'm not sure what the demands of the anti-war movement are right now, what would you do?
I would move to pull all the troops out very, very quickly. I mean, obviously, you can't pull over 150,000 troops and contractors out overnight. It took a few months to get them in. It'll take a few months to get them out. But I would begin the process now and say, we are declaring, one, a unilateral ceasefire. Two, we will stop preventing the possibility of a negotiated settlement, which, you know, if you listen to Obama administration officials, they even acknowledge that there will have to be a negotiated settlement at some point. The question they can't answer is, if that's the case, why not start now? Instead, we're reading that the Obama administration has essentially given up on the possibility of a negotiated settlement with the Taliban, and that's because they're setting the terms for what the Taliban has to meet by U.S. standards, instead of simply saying the Taliban is one of many forces, many political forces, none of whom reflect the same political approaches that people in the United States do, and that's because we don't live there. What a concept. It's not our country. What a concept. So it's true. I mean, the Taliban represents an incredibly backward, misogynistic, dangerous type of governance. That's absolutely true. Anyone who denies that, I think, is deluding themselves. But what we don't hear about is that the Karzai government is only barely better, and that little bit is only rhetorical. The other militias that are functioning in and around Afghanistan are not that different from the Taliban. The Taliban were never a threat to the United States until we invaded their country. The Taliban never wanted to govern Washington. They wanted to govern Kabul. And part of the reason they won the civil war in 1996, after a devastating four-year-long civil war that almost destroyed the capital and killed thousands of people, armed by U.S.-provided arms from a decade-long war against the Soviet Union, the reason the Taliban won was because they told people they would end the war. For a brief moment, they did, for a few years, until we invaded. Doesn't mean it was good for people in Afghanistan to have a Taliban government. It was a terrible arrangement. But the only way that was going to end would have been for Afghans themselves, Afghan women to organize themselves, Afghans themselves across the board to organize to change their own country. It never works when it's imposed from outside. Afghanistan is simply not an exception to that reality.
So, Phyllis, going forward, any optimism at all? Is there any anti-war movement doing anything around Afghanistan?
There is. There is. We saw veterans, anti-war veterans from Veterans for Peace and Iraq Veterans Against the War, Afghanistan Veterans Against the War, who were out in force on this last weekend, on October 7th, the anniversary, the 11th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of 2001, who were reading the names of those who have died and demanding an end, demanding that troops be withdrawn. We are certainly not seeing a lot of protests in the street, but we're seeing a lot of motion in areas like bird-dogging candidates and demanding more clarity on what the position should be. We see moves in Congress. Barbara Lee and others have introduced resolutions that say that the only money that should be spent in Afghanistan is whatever it costs to get the troops safely out. So there is an anti-war movement. It's not as visible as it has been at earlier times. I think that may return. I don't think we can measure anti-war, either anti-war sentiment or anti-war mobilization, solely by the numbers in the street. That's obviously one important part. But the fact, remember, Michael, when the U.S. invaded Afghanistan, only 12% of people in this country thought it was a bad idea. The fear factor that Bush had engendered, the way that the opposition to what had happened on September 11th.
I'm surprised it was 12%, Phyllis. I remember, like, we had some
friends. You remember it.
Even Richard Falk for a while was in favor of it.
But he immediately changed.
No, he did. I'm just saying, but I'm just, even, he's a close friend, and we were going to, Richard and I were going to debate the issue, and then by the time we got to the debate, he changed. But it just shows you how hard it was to oppose it then.
It was, but you remember, Michael, that on the day that the U.S. invaded, October 7th, there was the first anti-war protest underway in New York City, in Washington Square Park. And the reason I remember it so carefully is that I couldn't go. I was doing some media stuff here in D.C., and I was watching, because the word was it was going to begin that day, and I was monitoring it, and I saw the announcement of the first bombing, and I remember calling Leslie Kagan, who was doing such great organizing of that event. I reached her backstage, and I said, the bombing has just begun. So we were already in the streets that day. People had not given up. There weren't very many of us. There weren't very many at that protest that day. You were probably there. But it began, and it took off. But look where we are now. 68% of people in the last poll said the war was not worth fighting. 74% said the troops should be withdrawn. So we have transformed the discourse on this war. We have transformed the understanding in this country because of that anti-war movement. The problem we face is our problem, not Afghanistan's problem. Our problem is that our democracy is so flawed that public opinion simply doesn't have the kind of impact we need it to have on our policy.
I think that's really important, Phyllis. I think that's right.
We saw the same thing with Iraq. It took a couple of years, and we suddenly had a majority of public opinion on our side. We're seeing it now on Palestine. There's a massive shift underway, as you know well, Michael, about public opinion on Israel-Palestine. But we're seeing no effect so far in the policy. That's the hardest part of our work. It's not building an anti-war movement. It's making our government take into account the opinions of not only a movement, but of the American people as a whole.
Well, thank you very much, Phyllis. Before I close, I have two things from you. One is your last book and where people can go to get more of your writings and speaking, etc.
People can sign up to get my newsletter on the IPS website, and they can see most of my writing there as well. That's ips-dc.org. My most recent book is the latest updated edition. It just came out a couple of months ago, of my primer on Israel-Palestine. It's called Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict, a Primer.
Phyllis Bennis, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Michael.
Thanks, Phyllis. Good. You must be going crazy giving all these interviews, right? If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
Africa. Thank you.